So I'm Jim Johnston. I'm an audio architect at Microsoft. I use XP Pro. My wife uses Ubuntu and FreeBSD. She works for Cray. It's not my fault. I'm supposed to introduce Elliot Omayo, who's a software architect at Microsoft, who's the speaker tonight. Who'd probably rather be skiing or roller skating, but here's Elliot.
Thank you. So this isn't my dad's EKIT AR-15. It's a picture I pulled off of eBay this morning, but that's how I got introduced to audio. So I've just dated myself in a really severe way. I watched him solder that, so that wasn't mine.
You're
right?
Young.
So the first slide looked like that. Okay, we all know why we're here. Actually, the number of people who said that you use Windows surprised me, because I grew up in Southern California, and they're notorious for never admitting that they use a Windows PC. So even if they used a Windows PC down there, they would never admit to it. It would be 100% Mac there. So it was actually kind of surprising how many people. This talk, since I work at Microsoft on the audio stack, is heavily oriented towards the PC and Windows on the PC. But as you'll find out kind of towards the end of this talk, everything in the industry is converging in one place. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And so some of that stuff, even if you're a diehard Linux or a Mac fan, will end up being useful for you. This talk is really, really basic. If you've done audio software development on Windows especially, probably not going to learn anything from these slides per se. But since we had a huge variability in terms of people's familiarity with audio on PCs, I had to kind of do a common denominator on those. But we'll try to make this as interactive as possible. I tried not to have too many slides for this talk so that we had a lot of time for questions. That being the case, I'm not an expert in a lot of things, so don't be surprised if the answer to some of your questions is, I don't know. So what is audio on the PC? One of the things I'm going to talk about, the main thing I'm going to talk to you about tonight is what we call streaming, which is getting data from one place to another. This is not a talk about digital signal processing. It's not a talk about codec techniques or any of those things, although we'll touch on some of those issues later. And by the end of this, hopefully you'll want to hear the other talks of JJ's that you have not yet heard. So, when we talk about streaming, we want to get the crucial audio data from one place to another. So we talk about source and destination, and the ultimate destination is your ears. But when we think about it on the PC, the real destination that we have is the audio hardware in your computer. And so we'll talk a little bit about where that is and what it means and the different kinds of audio hardware that you might encounter on PCs. And when I say PCs now, I mean, we're increasingly, and especially within the last 6 months, talking about Intel motherboards designed by Intel in Oregon and California, running a variety of operating systems. And so now what we have is a convergence of a common hardware platform, common audio specifications for that hardware, and then different kinds of software stacks above those. But as we'll talk about this, these software stacks that live above these things, we're talking about software stacks that do essentially the same thing. I mean, if you run Pro Tools on a Mac or you run Pro Tools on Windows, it doesn't act much different. You have different kinds of configuration problems. The software managers are accessed a little bit differently, but basically the functions are the same because the process of streaming from one place to another is the same on all of these computing platforms now. The purpose of the second bullet is we're just going to introduce lots and lots and lots of TLAs. Three-letter acronyms, some of them are two and four letters. But what I try to do is at least introduce you to a number of these that you've heard before. Maybe you do or don't know what they mean, but then you'll get an introduction, and we can try to tie these together and try to paint a picture so you understand what's happening inside that weird box of yours that makes music sometimes. I think the last bullet is just a plug for JJ's talk. So we're going to move data from one place to another for the purpose of cochlear excitation. Okay, so what's actually happening on your PC? So this is when you're doing Windows Media Player, using Pro Tools to record, et cetera, et cetera. It's all basically the same thing. We're going to acquire from a source, and that's a fixed or removable disk, an internet radio stream, or a microphone hooked up to your computer, et cetera. It's going to go through the audio hardware in some fashion, and we'll get into some detail on that a little later. It'll move into the memory of your PC, and then somehow it'll go from the memory on your PC to the audio hardware. And how that happens is the subject of some of these slides. Once it gets onto the audio hardware, then we're on a common platform. If you're running BSD, Linux, Windows, Mac, whatever, it's all the same at that point because you're hitting common hardware, and then it's going to hit a DAC on that thing, and then there's going to be a little jack on the end of that DAC, which is going to be subject to some amount of amplification, either a little bit or a lot. And when we say a lot on a PC, we're usually talking about 5 watts, which is about the maximum you can put out of that kind of hardware before you start having issues with circuit design. And then eventually to your speakers or an outboard audio-video receiver or some such thing.
Are you going to define these PLAs?
Yeah, and if I don't, then yell at me for not talking about this. So yeah. This one is digital audio analog conversion. So do we want to talk about what that means a little bit? Okay, so you guys know what a DAC is, at least in concept. So let's contrast this to a piece of consumer electronics. You acquire from a source, you do digital analog conversion, you do some amount of power amplification, and you output. Geez, it's like the same, right? So it's not really that much different, right? I mean, it's all basically the same thing. You're moving audio samples from one place to another. Well, actually, it is a lot different. Gentleman in the front said all of his music is now on hard disk. We're evolving to a system in our home like that, too. So one of the key differences between a piece of consumer electronics thing is internal storage, right? You have big hard disks on your computers now. Portability. I mean, I've got probably, 1,000 songs on this laptop that I can carry anywhere. I've got a Dell jukebox player that's got an equal number of songs on it. I mean, you didn't used to be able to do this with consumer electronics. It's carry around that much music because now we have hard drives on them. Customizability, custom playlists and those sorts of things, shuffling internet radio stations, those sorts of things. Time shifting. I shouldn't admit this, but I, you know, record internet radio streams, put them on various things, listen to them later, same thing like people do with TiVos. Geo-shifting. My favorite radio stations in L.A., KCRW in Santa Monica, listen to that every day. You know, before the advent of internet radio and computer audio, you couldn't do that. There's a larger choice of material. You could argue whether or not that's a good thing and whether the quality is any better because you have a larger choice. But there is a larger choice. And I think the last thing is one of the most important things. And I think the last bullet really affects everybody in this room in some way, shape, or form. All of the existing economic models you knew as the LP and CD-based music industry is no longer the same. iTunes by itself has really disturbed a lot of things. Now, it's arguable whether that's any better, right? I mean, do musicians make any more money now as a result of these changing economic models? I think that's pretty debatable. But it's undeniable that a lot of the things that you know and have done in the past are no longer applicable because of this thing we call the PC. So, like it or not, I think it's here to stay and has had a profound impact that is not yet finished happening. And we'll talk a little bit about futures on the last slide, but a lot of that's speculative, and I don't really delve in the economic and the business model end of this business as much as I do the technical side. So, okay, so I think I've covered this. We're just moving audio data from one spot to another and doing final digital analog conversion and amplifying it and then putting it out of a jack. So the fact that you have a little piece of silicon on your motherboard that has a digital analog converter and a little cheap amplifier on it, is that really useful? Well, it turns out that's not really useful. That is whatever brand of computer you want to talk about in 1990. Anybody who wrote audio software in 1990 knew you had to write software for a particular sound card, and then you had to write a little bit different software for a little different sound card, and a little bit different software from that for the third sound card, and then you were out of sound cards. But the thing was is that there was no standardization of application program interfaces, what software engineers like to call APIs, and hardware standards and interface standards and those sorts of things. So 15 years ago, this stuff was very, very difficult to write software for. And so there was no way that we were going to be able to create an industry that most of you work in or are studying to work in without some amount of operating system or software stacks on that. And so a lot of what I'll talk about in the next hour or so is, you know, what is a software stack and what is it doing, and how, and what happens when you're either running software on that stack or writing software that, interfaces with those APIs. There are two basic functions of the OS audio stack software. And this is generic. This is same on Core Audio on OS X and on the PC. Now, I don't know anything about how the API is on Linux, so some of you who know or are more familiar with that, maybe you can help out with information there. But there's two basic things. It's like enumeration. It's like, what audio devices do you have on your computer? And streaming. It's like, how do you open that device, get it prepared, and then actually start sending audio data to it, so you either can, or sending data for render or receiving data for capture or recording. And so we'll talk about some of how that goes. So this slide's pretty self-explanatory. Half of what I do at work is draw boxes on whiteboards. And then supposedly somebody like gains some inspiration from that, and then we write software, and hopefully when you get it, it works. So that's what I do. I draw boxes. So in its worst incarnation, we work on software for a really, really, really long time, and then it looks like this. This slide comes from a deck that I give sometimes, which explains how much better the audio stack is in Vista. And I'll talk a little bit about that at the end, but that was really mostly a joke about drawing boxes. So here's the simple block diagram. You have a source. That source may or may not go through a codec, and we'll use that term really loosely right now and then define it in more detail later. It gets to an audio API buffer, which is a little piece of memory that's dedicated to receive audio data over and over and over again. So you keep putting more and different stream audio samples on there, either render or capture, and then eventually it'll end up either coming from the audio hardware in capture or going to the audio hardware in render. The key thing here is, I don't care what platform you're using, it all ends up coming PCM. Okay, so there's another one of our three-letter acronyms that we'll spend a little bit of time talking about right now. So all of your data ultimately ends up in that format. Typically doesn't start out in that format. There's different variations of the format of that, and we'll talk about that in a second, but that's basically what you end up with. So really the point of this slide is just an intro to what is PCM. PCM stands for Pulse Code Modulation. This is generally, and I believe correctly, attributed to Harry Nyquist, who invented this at Bell Labs, of course, because almost everything associated with audio that's original came from Bell Labs, right? Including JJ. And I didn't put this on there, but I think it's on the next slide. So Harry invented first frequency division multiplexing, and then didn't invent but perfected time division multiplexing. And these two things, which may not be familiar to you, but this became the landline telephone as you know it. I mean, there would be no telephone without these innovations. And so basically, he invented the telephone as you know it. Now, TDM, which is the phone system that we had at least until the 1960s, I asked JJ about this the other day, but I think it was around the 1960s that generation really came to its highest penetration, is a sequential transmission of signals over a line. What was being transmitted was PCM. Hey, JJ, TDM, I asked you about this last week. So this was the phone system as we knew it in 1960s, right?
That's how you actually got longer distance calls to work.
Right. Okay.
Which is basically PCM without the quantization, using an analog switch.
Right. Okay. So some people think Holter's bouquet invented sampling in 1978. It's not true. Sampling was invented in 1928 by Harry Nyquist, and that's actually the name of the paper in which he described this. And I didn't actually look for this paper on the internet, but I'm assuming that's available, and I'd certainly love to read that sometime. An audio signal can be conveyed just by sampling the amplitude at certain levels. And so all it is a certain number of times a second, see what the amplitude is at that very short amount of time, and then record it. And then that ends up being an integer between 0 and 65,535, which is, we call that 64K. Or if you use float systems, as you know, some of the pro audio software brags about being float 32 and float 64, ends up being a number of very high precision between 0 and 1. And that's basically what it is. Now, the critical thing that Harry Nyquist figured out is that the sampling frequency, which is 1 over T, must be 2 times the maximum bandwidth, or f of s is greater than or equal to 2 f of a. Clear? I'll get to more explanation in the next slide. So therefore, there's 2 frequencies. There's the audio frequency, and then there's the sampling rate. So I don't know how much math I'm allowed to give in this thing. That was probably too much math. So what that means is human hearing goes to approximately 20K. Babies can hear that high. Nobody in this room can probably hear that high. So who's heard the story about the ringtone that the kids use? So I'll tell you this story really quickly. In, I think, England, they invented this thing because kids would stand outside of convenience stores and drink and carouse and scare all the customers away. So this audio engineer in Europe somewhere invented this system where they'd put up a loudspeaker and they would output a 17,500 kilohertz irritating tone. And what it would do is it would drive all the kids away because they were the only ones who could hear this tone, right? So the adult, they couldn't hear this, and so it wouldn't bother them, so it would drive the kids away, and then the adults would sit there. Well, don't do this to kids, right? Because it didn't take long for a very enterprising kid to figure out, wow, I can take this signal, I can make a ringtone out of it. And so when they go into class and they can't use their cell phone, well, they use this ringtone, it rings, everybody in the class can hear this thing. Teacher's 40 years old, can't hear anything. So anyway, theoretically speaking, these signals go for a range of human hearing 20 to 20K hertz. And so what the Nyquist sampling theory says is that the sampling rate must be double the maximum frequency, the maximum nominal frequency. Now, the way this ends up becoming more familiar to you is everybody's heard of 44.1, right? That's a CD. CD's 44.1. What does that mean? That means the pulse code modulation sampling was 44,100 times per second, and it usually means stereo, and we'll talk about how many bytes and bits and all what that other means in just a second. So that's what that means is 44.1 is for a maximum frequency of 22050. Another story is, who's heard of how the length of a CD was determined? Okay. That story goes, well, and I'll be interested to see if you heard a different story than one I think is true. So Sony invented the CD along with Philips, and can't remember the guy at Sony's name right now.
Yasuda.
No, the research I did turned up another name, but his wife, her favorite piece of music was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So they actually selected the bit density for the disc and the sampling rate so that Beethoven's Ninth Symphony would fit on one CD. So did anybody hear a different version of that story?
I heard that it was because of the consortium aspect, Deutsche Grammophon was involved. and Herbert von Karajan as president.
So I've heard the von Karajan story also, and so that one has...
Von Karajan that said, I should be able to put all of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony on one disc, and they said, how long is it? He said, about 74 minutes. And we ended up with that.
Okay, so the key thing there is that, and that during that time, which I think is about the late 70s or 1980, you know, they had a certain amount of capability in terms of recording density on this kind of medium. And so they knew what that was. And then they derived what was the highest sampling rate that then ended up with 74 minutes of music. So, JJ, I forgot to ask you this. Why not 40?
Well, if you
why
have,
because 2205 is such a weird number.
If the sampling rate is exactly twice the highest frequency, you need infinite time for the filter to operate. Minor technicality.
Okay, so that 10% of slop is enough?
10% of slop means that you only have to have... If you have 10% slop, it means you have to have about a minimum of a 20-sample impulse response in the filter to get the thing to work at all.
Okay, so we are not going to talk about FIRs tonight. I'm going to guess that there's less than 10% of the people in the room who will care or not be incredibly bored by that. We actually have to process these signals, and there are mathematical algorithms for doing those. But I actually wondered that, because, I mean, you know, nominally, you would think that what we would do is we would have 40K and then 20K maximum frequency. But there's a little bit of mathematics involved on that. So, PCM on a PC, and this also applies to Macs and Linux and everything, because now we have WAV files. What is a WAV file? A WAV file is a whole bunch of PCM samples with a little bit of header on that. And Microsoft, in approximately 1991, invented the resource interchange file format, RIF files. But what that is, the only real manifestation remaining of that is WAV files, because basically almost nobody uses AVI files anymore. So the last remaining vestige of that is WAV files. On the PC platform, at least, the structure we call WaveFormatEX and some other ones, which I'll show in a second, describe the PCM data. So we have number of channels, the sampling rate that we just discussed, 44.1, 48, 96, etc., and then the block alignment, which is in one sample, that one bit of data that we grab 44,100 times a second. How big is that? So now we've derived the etymology of 1644 or 2496. So the 16 comes from here, and the 44 is the sampling rate. And JJ put a comment on this slide that says the number of channels is fundamentally a different kind of information from the 1644 kind of information. You want to explain that?
Well, the point is that you can convert bit depth and sampling rate automatically. That's a mathematical function. It's just defined. What you do when the number of channels changes is interesting.
Right. And for those of you who work in digital media division at Microsoft, we spend lots and lots and lots of time talking about fold down and matrixing and those sorts of things. It ends up being a very complicated part of our job.
Does WAV stand for something?
Waveform.
That's it.
Yeah. So that itself is a abbreviation, not a TLA. So this is of marginal technical interest, but this format description has changed over time. We started at WAV format, and then we got to PCM format, and then we got to WAV format EX, and then we have WAV format extensible. And I, along with some other people in the industry, are actually going to hope to come to a meeting of minds about creating 64-bit WAV format descriptions so that we can actually end up having WAV files that are greater than 4 gigabytes.
Use Apple's Core Audio file format.
That might end up being the right answer. We have some other questions and needs that we have on that. So we're not actually out to change anything that anybody else has done. What we want to do is make sure that we can have a common industry standard and then we can actually do software platform innovations in the future. So I think that there's the other thing is that we have something to do with European reconcile with something in European broadcasters, and there's currently activity in AES around that.
Which the Apple format does not resolve.
Yeah. So I think that all of these efforts are a step in the right direction. We actually need to converge on something that everybody will be able to support. So that's hopefully going to happen in the next couple of years. These being stuff we're trying to do through the AES, many of you know how long that takes. Okay, let's do a little bit more math, and this one's guaranteed simple. This is, how do you take all of that information and calculate either size or time? Okay, so what block alignment of 16 bits means is, given that there's 8 bits in a byte, that means there's 2 bytes of data. So every PCM sample for that stereo ends up being of size 2. So 1 second of data in PCM is your sampling rate times 16-bit times the number of channels divided by the number of bits in a byte, which means that 44.1 is 176,400. So the easy way to figure out that is it's this number times 4. That's basically what that works out for. So that's the easy, quick calculation. If you have 6 channels, then you have to multiply by 3 because you have 3 times as much information because you have 3 times as many channels. So what that ends up being is 176,400 bytes per second is 635 megabytes for 1 hour of music, and then you end up with a CD being 74 minutes or 783 megabytes. So one of the very first things that you could do at a consumer level on the PC back in 1990 was stick a CD into a $500 CD drive, that thing you can buy for $20 now, or maybe even less, and then play it. So what was happening then, and what is still happening now when you either play or rip a CD? Well, we find the CD drive, so you use the OS functions of your choice to enumerate all the drives in the system, and then ask that drive, what kind of drive are you? Do you have removable media? And then you go ask that media, what kind of media are you? And the OS will tell you, oh, that's an audio CD. And then you spin that thing up by opening it, basically, and then you read the table of contents. The header of a CD is really, really simple. It's got a serial number on it that hopefully uniquely identifies it, and it's got the number of tracks and where that track starts on the disk. And then basically it's just got a whole bunch of PCM WAV file data put onto the disk.
Finally started putting serial numbers on CDs?
Well, it depends. Yeah, basically. I mean, that's how CDDB or GraceNet lookups look. Like, you get a code.
Well, they do a hash of, like, the song links.
Yeah, they do that, all that stuff, because all that information is not, because basically the information you get off the header is not unique, right? Not guaranteed unique. So, yes. So it's a big guessing game. I was discussing this with some people over dinner. What's amazing to me on those kinds of lookups is how often it's right. So we start reading the information for a particular track, track 1 or track 11 or whatever, and that track is guaranteed, if it's a Redbook CD audio, to be 44.1 16-bit stereo PCM data. And then we stream it to the audio hardware, and then, voila. Except we don't know what streaming is yet, so that's kind of a problem. So, at its most basic form, audio on the PC means get some PCM data from your source to your audio hardware. The details here are some, from, and to. So the from is some client or application. That's the program, the software program that's going to use the audio API on a particular platform. The two is they're going to transfer a little bit of that data to some region of memory defined by that audio API. And streaming ends up being the orderly transfer of buffers from one place to another. Simple enough. But the key challenge here is you're moving around little bits of data, but you must do it on time. Who knows what it's called when you don't move data on time in a PC? Actually, the word is glitch. So you're all familiar with that term. If you don't get data where it's supposed to go on time, you get a glitch. Now, I think anybody who's run audio, pro audio software and tried to run the latency are really low and it starts going click, 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 almost everybody must know what that sounds like. That's a glitch. What that means is that data did not get from point A to point B on time. So we'll spend a little bit of time talking about what does on time mean. When your Pro Audio interface or software or something says use a buffer size of 512 frames or 256 frames, what does that mean? And why does that mean, well, how does that govern latency? So the key message on this slide is buffer size and latency are really the same thing, okay? And so basically, the smaller the buffer, the lower the latency. And so that's a good thing, right? We all want low latency, especially when you're doing live kind of work. Long latency kills. Unfortunately, the smaller the buffer, the harder it is to get that buffer to the right place on time. And so that's basically the knob you have when you're dealing with audio software on the PC is how big is that buffer that you're repeatedly cycling so that you can get the audio data to or from the hardware. The example here is the very first Discman or the very first car stereos. They had tiny, 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 tiny little buffers. They basically read a little bit off the disc, and then they dropped it on the DAC, and they came out the speakers. What happens if you hit a bump in the road? You just lost it, right? So what did they do? They just buffered up a whole bunch of data. They would spin up the disc, and they would read up a second or two's worth of data, and then they would hold it there. And so if you hit a bump in the road or you bump your portable CD player, it's going to miss track, it's going to lose its place, it's not going to be able to read the data, and then it's got the amount of the buffer to recover from that and keep reading and refill the buffer, okay? But the problem with this is after a while, it's a second ahead reading from where your ear is. Does that matter when you're playing a CD? Doesn't matter at all, right? Because it doesn't matter how far ahead your buffers. In other situations, it does matter and you have to run much smaller buffers. Any of you who play with Windows Media Player, iTunes, Winamp, any of those kinds of pieces of software, they're typically buffering anywhere from 100 milliseconds to a second's worth of data ahead. And why do they do that? It's because they don't want to have to deal with the problems associated with low latency and on-time delivery of audio samples. And it doesn't matter in that application, right? Because you can't tell how far ahead they're reading the disk or sucking the bytes off of the internet. So at what rate is an important question when you're streaming? Now, when we record and master, eventually produce a CD or some sort of audio file, we've done it at, you know, 2496 and then mastered for CD at 44.1 or whatever it is. And we assume, as a matter of course, that when it comes out of whatever it's being played on, that it will come out after 1 second, 44,100 samples will have been played. Well, I'll tell you, in none of those pieces of hardware will that happen. It will always, 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 always be wrong. There's two reasons for that. One is that no audio clock crystal is 100% accurate. And the other part of that is no two crystals are ever the same on that. And then the third thing is that in a PC, there's at least one more clock. That's called the system clock. That's the one the operating system uses to do what we call scheduling, which is give threads. Sorry, now I'm getting into all this other technical detail. It's how work gets scheduled on the computer. So that's called the system clock. And that's inherently and completely different from the audio clock. So we're always fighting this thing about at what rate does it actually play back at.
And hardware vendors are rabidly opposed to making synchronous.
And for good reason, too.
Well, yes and no, but yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit. I've got a block diagram of the Vista audio stack, it happens to be, but it can be generically described at the end of this talk. And the whole idea that you can impose predictability in this thing is ultimately fail. Basically, what we do is we compensate for all of these timing invariants. And those of you who deal with jitter and, you know, single clock sources and those sorts of things are well aware of the sorts of issues and problems you have with this. So if you cannot rely on the audio hardware and the software stack that reflects the audio hardware to know, or excuse me, to play back or to record at a certain speed, what are you going to do? Because you can no longer rely on the rate at which something is played or captured. So then you have to play the where am I game. So the other critical function provided by an audio API is where am I right now? At what position am I? And for fixed rate formats like PCM, ideally you would never ask this question. But of course we just found out you always have this question because the position can never be predicted accurately. So the two positions that are important is how much data has been received. Okay, so let's talk about playback right now. So the act of streaming on playback is you're going to take audio samples from one place and then put it on a buffer that the audio hardware DAC can consume. And so basically what happens is you're going to read from your source and then put a bunch of data repeatedly onto that audio buffer so that it can be played out. So the first one is what we call play position. How much data have I ever sent to that piece of audio hardware? And then the other question, critical thing, is how much data of what I've sent has been consumed. The delta between those two happens to be your buffering, but that's kind of an issue that is not too important. Okay, so just to reiterate, the last bullet's the important one, is the application's concept of time, which is built off of the system clock, is never equal to the audio clock. The audio clock's always a separate clock, crystal frequency oscillator, than the frequency oscillator that the CPU uses. Okay, and the audio clock, if it's not already obvious, governs the rate at which the audio hardware will consume the data that you give it, and the opposite for capture and recording. Is everybody keeping up? Is this making sense? Okay. Before 2 years ago when I started working on audio, I'd never heard of this word before, and it took me a long time to understand what this meant. So we use this term, and it's actually kind of unique to audio and video, but it's mostly used with audio, which is this thing called isochronous. Now, if you've dealt with software at all, you've heard of synchronous and asynchronous. A synchronous operation means I go call over there, and when I'll go knock on the door, wait for somebody to come to the door, they open the door, I ask them to do something, they go away, they come back, and then I leave. The thing about a synchronous operation is you wait until it's fully complete until you return. Asynchronous is I knock on the door, I tell whoever's behind the door, go do this, and then I run away. Like, I don't know when they're going to finish it. I don't know when they're going to do it. I don't know when they're going to finish it. And so this is often also called fire and forget. Now, later on, you're going to want to ask them or have them tell you somehow that I actually finished what I told you. But the point about asynchronous is that you're not going to wait around for them to do the operation. You're going to go away. Well, I thought isochronous was some third kind of weird thing that was neither synchronous or asynchronous. And that was only half right. What isochronous means is get the bits there on time. That's all it means. You can do that with synchronous operations, or you can do with asynchronous operations. When we talk about lock-free, non-blocking streaming at the very end, we'll find out that most of these audio pipelines that are used in tools like Pro Tools or low-latency drivers like DirectKS and Osio, they tend to be what we call non-blocking and lock-free. What it tends to happen is we have asynchronous software operations in order to achieve isochronous transfer. But these are all big, weird words that are probably only mostly useful in crossword puzzles. But basically, what that means is that get the data there on time. Okay, APIs, application programming interfaces, and for those of you who run lots and lots of different versions of Windows, this is kind of the story of your life over the last 15 years. It's interesting that prior to 15 years ago, the thing I'm talking about here did not even exist, I mean, like in any way, shape, or form. So it's amazing that, you know, computing's been around for a long time, but the stuff that we're working on now that affects almost the way we do everything, or large parts of everything that we do with audio, has only been around for 15 years. And in the first few years, it was extremely primitive and hard to program, and the performances actually was not that good either. So I won't bore you with the details here, but some interesting things are, audio gets invented 10 years ago. K-Mixer, which some of you may know and love, was invented 8 years ago. And the full realization of what I would call high-performance audio that's capable for pro audio actually didn't happen until the Windows 2000 era, and then shortly thereafter, Windows XP. So then we had WDM drivers and those sorts of things. Core audio on OS X came out when? Does anybody know that?
Well, Next Step came out in 1988, and they had an API for...
How well did you think that worked? Did you program that API?
Yeah.
How well did you think it worked?
Pretty abstract, but C-Sound and a lot of the French guys at EarCam used it. It was pretty abstract from the hardware. It was an object-oriented operating system, so...
Did you actually use it to do audio programming?
Yeah, you could. It's object-oriented programming. I don't think you could write a video game with it.
So what was it good for? I mean, I didn't mess with that system, so I don't really know.
It was good for providing application developers with like a pretty high-level minimum platform.
And was that good for like system sounds or streaming wave or?
They did all kinds of experimental music with it and audio applications. I don't know if you would call them.
Sure. Yeah. Of course.
Like that elaborate, but
right.
The whole spectrum. What was nice for was that none of those developers had to be concerned with the hardware at all.
The other interesting end of that story is Next became the programming platform for OS X.
Right.
And so now, if you write either software internally at Apple or you write software on top of the Apple operating system, targeting OS X now running on the Intel platform, you're doing Next. You know, the current evolution of Next Step programming.
A handful of different things, and one of them is that. They've got QuickTime, they've got a lot of old legacy stuff as well.
Right. Okay. So I assume that nobody wants to know the API details. If you do, we can talk about that in Q&A.
Get your little broadcast time.
But there's a lot of, gory details in this. Trying to talk about this at a high conceptual level, but when you get into it, there's a lot of devil in the details on this. This is, I think, some of the more challenging software programming there is. I mean, getting data from one place to another on time sounds simple, but it's really pretty difficult to do it reliably. In the back?
Are you going to get into drivers and how those work and how you set them up?
I won't, but I'll try to answer questions to the best of my ability. And I actually will talk about them from the standpoint of what class drivers mean on the, especially on the Windows platform. But that applies to the Mac platform even more, because the Mac actually has an even higher penetration of class driverness, if you will, than even the PC. So we're kind of converging on that. But why don't we save that to the end? We'll actually probably get to that in the second half of the talk, because we're going to split this in two and do the tour in the middle and the election, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And then if I haven't answered your question, then let's talk about it some more. But yes, hopefully we will get to some level of that.
It'd be a good place to break.
Yeah, Elliot, we're about 45 minutes.
Okay. No, this is a great place to break. It's okay. Perfect.